That's why it's so popular.
Yes.
So much water. If you look online, they count the fish. So they do drift drives and they tell you how many fish per kilometre there are in each section of the river if you look for it. So approach every section of water with the fly in your hand, line out of the rod tip, ready to go.
G'day and welcome to another instalment of the Fly Fishers podcast.
Since 1967, we've been spreading the bug of fly fishing at our Melbourne fly shop.
Join us as we celebrate the fun of fly fishing and chat with characters that enjoy it as much as we do.
Whether you're just starting out or have some experience, we hope our ego-free commentary helps demystify fly fishing and inspires you to visit new places and try new techniques.
Ever dreamed of chasing wild trout in crystal clear rivers surrounded by breathtaking landscapes? Welcome to the South Island of New Zealand, the ultimate fly fishing destination. And for Aussies, it's the ultimate affordable fly fishing destination. I'm joined by our very own Peter Blackmore today for the podcast. Blackers, as he's more affectionately known. Welcome to the podcast, mate.
Thanks, Andrew.
New Zealand. You are a fly fisher that travels to New Zealand regularly. You've done probably no less than 20 trips to the South Island. And more recently, you host affordable fly fishing holidays to New Zealand as well. So you're very familiar with that island and there's obviously something about it to you that draws you back time after time. What is it about the South Island of New Zealand that makes it so special?
One of the things with the South Island is you can't take a bad photograph. And that's probably the crux of it. I mean, you can catch fish anywhere. You can catch fish anywhere in Australia,
yep.
You know, except for probably the Northern Territory in terms of trout. But the spectacle of fishing in New Zealand, obviously there's very large fish, there's, you know, the gin clear waters, all the stuff you see on videos. It's actually very approachable. You don't have to be, a super-duper expert. I've taken, as you said, I run some affordable trips to New Zealand for club members. And there's quite a few people who are very new to fly fishing and they all catch fish. So it's not, it's not that difficult.
Yeah, yeah. So would you say pretty much anyone could turn up to New Zealand as an Aussie fly fisher that's got some experience here and have success in a place like the South Island?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But you could also do a long trip and not catch any fish, just to be honest. But if you're prepared to find out what's going on, like come into the fly fisher, talk to people, have the right gear, go to the right places, you'll see big fish and you'll catch fish.
Yeah. So having the right tools and information before you go is obviously key to success in planning a trip.
Yeah. So there's plenty of books here we have here. There's lots of resources online, but information's king.
Yeah.
And there's some really good online stuff from created in New Zealand by department of, their various departments. So, information's there, but come in, talk to someone, tell us your ideas and we can pretty much help you out wherever you want to go.
Map a bit of a trip together. But we're going to get into that. We're going to have some travel tips, a bit of gear advice, and certainly we're going to mention a few must-visit rivers and lakes. So keep listening and we'll get into it. But first of all, getting to the South Island of New Zealand, there's two major hubs being Christchurch and Queenstown. It seems that's where the majority of flights that leave Australia get to the South Island, is that right?
Or? Yeah, they're the two international airports. New Zealand, it's two islands, obviously, but just the South Island, it's a 13-hour drive from north to south.
It's not that bad. Yeah,
but it's still quite a distance. So if you were to focus on the particular parts of New Zealand, like you'd go into Christchurch if you want to go up to, Murchison, Hanmer Springs, Nelson, the West Coast. Christchurch is probably a better destination. Most Aussies for their first time really look at landing into Queenstown, heading down to Lumsden, down to the iconic South Island rivers that are down there. But New Zealand, the South Island is a big island. There's plenty of opportunities, but they're the two main hubs.
yeah.
that you want to get into.
Would you say the country and the scenery, does it get more spectacular the further south you get towards Fiordland, or is it just pretty stunning the whole way down?
New Zealand's a very new country in terms of not just a country, but actual landmass. So it tends to come up quite strikingly, unlike Australia, which has been around for a long time, and all the our mountains are well rounded. So New Zealand's got a lot of mountains that just seem to just come up from the valley floor, like really steep. Some of them you just can't walk over, they're that steep. But spectacular. You've got Fiordland, which is obviously, you know, beautiful, big rivers. In Nelson, there are a number of rivers there that you can get into, probably helicopter fishing, that are very, very different, heavily wooded, lots of beech trees, very difficult walking, and it's very, very different to the south.
Right.
Yeah, very different.
Okay. Yeah, so we'll, I guess we'll get a bit further into the various locations and fishing out of those two major hubs. What season-wise, though, what is the New Zealand trout season? How does that look?
So if we're just – well, obviously we're just talking about the South Island, so it's basically October through to April. They've got a closed season there, most of the rivers. Some of the rivers – lower down are open, closer to the sea. Some of the big rivers like the Clutha are open, which are probably best fished with double-handed rods. And there's guides there if you want to have an experience of double-handed fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Winter's your time on the Clutha River with some of the guides there.
For trout or salmon?
For trout.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
They get salmon there too doing
that. They do get salmon,
yeah. Yep. Okay, cool. But if, you know, for you personally, where the draw of the South Island for you, what time of year is that typically?
Strange enough, I've been there in all of those months. So I've been snowed on in February. I've had nothing but good weather in October. You know, like it's, you just take your chances. It's quite variable.
Yep.
And that's not to say it's bad. If you're mobile, especially, you can move around quite easily from one range to another. So if the weather's coming in over the west coast, you jump in a car and drive an hour north or east and south and just get away from that weather. And, you can always find water that's clear and running well.
Yep. If you had an idea in your mind, okay, I want to be polarizing a spring creek and casting a willow grub pattern to a rising fish, is there a better time of year to experience that kind of thing, or a better time of year for the mayfly fishing, or what are the major insect activity things that we might see in the South Island?
Yeah. Obviously, January, February, a lot of willow grubs about right through into March. It's going to depend on how warm the weather is. That's what gets willow grubs going. Afternoon mayfly hatches on, you know, most of our southern rivers, extends right through until the close of the season. In fact, it's probably better in March. I'm running trips this year in March, getting away a little bit from the, you know, the February rush.
Right.
And that's something we need to probably talk about is, okay, like February might be the best month weather-wise and all the rest, but it's also the busiest month.
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, price to be paid for that.
Yeah.
And it's just busier.
Is the whole of the South Island, has it become a busy fishery now, or is it more condensed to that bottom of the South Island, Queenstown area, Tiarnow, that gets all the fishing traffic or the majority of it?
Yeah. So there's a little town called Lumsden that in February probably had more Australians in it than New Zealanders.
Wow. Well, Australia has more New Zealanders in it than New Zealand. So.
Well, that's true. Yeah, so that can be really busy around that area. Kiwis have introduced designated waters license to give themselves open access to a number of the iconic rivers. As a bit of a pushback from foreigners.
Mm.
Unfortunately, we're considered foreigners. The foreigners flooding in at, you know, at their busy times of year. That's something we just manage in our process when we're doing trips, but it's something to be really aware of. Again, come in the shops and discuss it with us. You know, if you want to fish those iconic rivers, you pay your $40 a day, but you take your chances.
Right. So does that reserve the river for you? How does it work?
No, it doesn't.
Right.
There are some rivers where it's a daily quota, the Clinton River, for instance. But the backcountry rivers, it's just they'll take the $40 off 500 people technically on one day. So there's no limit to how many licenses could be bought on one day, which is a bit bizarre because there's no restriction on the Kiwis arriving. So obviously 500 is an exaggeration, but they might sell 50 tickets for a particularly, you know, it's going to be a beautiful, warm, sunny day next Thursday. Yeah. So everybody decides I'm going to go and fish, you know, the Ōriki.
Yeah.
But all the Kiwis decide to go there as well. So there's no booking system.
Right.
So you just pay your $40, you rock up, and then you can't get a beat.
Okay. So if it's not managing the numbers on the water, then what is the point of it?
Stop us going there.
So it's just designed to make it a little more difficult, and they're hoping that that pushes less traffic to these designated waters.
Correct. That's right.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. I realize that they have to do something to manage the numbers, and I genuinely feel like it's at least a step in the right direction, but it does sound like it's pretty poorly managed at this point in time.
Yeah, so the number of people employed to check licenses isn't high. So you can understand that it could be, you know, 100 people on a river.
Mm.
And certainly in Matara, there's 100 people a day fishing the river, so you can't check them all.
Mm.
Unfortunately, Matara doesn't require a designated waters license. So something that is used to manage the process or the number of people there is the beat system, which is working really, really well. You can basically drive the highway down from Queenstown and you'll see the blue and white signs on the side of the road indicating this is a beat.
Mm-hmm.
You park, if there's a car there, you leave it alone.
Right.
It's taken.
Yeah.
Or you could fish behind them, but I don't know why you would. So there's no car park there, then it's yours.
Right.
And then you fish upstream of that until you reach the, you know, the logical end point and you don't go any further.
What we're talking about really is basic fishing etiquette. Why is that important in a place like New Zealand? I mean, we go up to the Goulburn River and park at the bridge there in Thornton. There might be 10 other cars. No problem. You know, it's not the same. Why is it so different in the South Island?
The fish aren't small for a start. They're very large fish. They're pretty smart. You know, they're not young fish. They've been around for a while. They've seen a lot of anglers. They've seen a lot of flies. So basically, if you've walked over a fish, that's down for the day.
Mm.
That fish probably won't come back and eat again that day. So if you're walking behind someone, you'll know it. Because you won't see any fish. They just go away. They just go down deep and hide.
Yep. Wow. Okay. And if you do come across a trout and he's just not interested in flies or, dare I say, not even feeding, is that likely a byproduct of him having been, or her fish, been fished over before, earlier in the day?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. They'll just go doggo.
Yeah.
Just won't eat.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the fishery is quite different to, say, the numbers and density of fish that we might have in our northeast rivers, for instance.
Yeah, it's just to catch a, you know, if you caught a 1-pound fish in most of these rivers, you'd be quite surprised because they live further down in the lower part of the estuary for most of the year. And once they build some size up, they'll come up.
Wow.
So fish are constantly moving up from lower down because all the rivers are quite large and there's a lot of them.
Mm.
So there's some of the spring creeks, which I won't name here, but not too far from Queenstown. Very large fish. Like the spring creek, until they start feeding it at about 1:45, you won't see a fish. And suddenly there's 6, 7, 8-pound fish rising around you everywhere. So those fish move up from the ocean constantly looking for cold fresh water and then moving back down again. And yeah, so there's constant movement of fish through these systems. And you need to be mindful that the fish need to have a break.
Mm.
And so that's getting fished over constantly is a problem for them.
Right. Okay. So you just mentioned a time of day where all of a sudden the fish come out. Is that because it is almost on the clock that fish seem to start rising in some of these spring creeks?
Yeah. So that it's a hatch-driven fishery. Obviously, you can fish all day. Don't have to wait till 1:45. But certain rivers or certain creeks, it really doesn't work. They just don't. There's no hatch until that time. Mm. And once the hatch is on, the fish are on.
Yeah, wow.
But the some of the bigger rivers, you fish for the fish all the time.
Mm.
A fish is never going to refuse a cicada.
Yeah.
They're always going to come and have a look at it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a big meal ticket item. But when it's a hatch-driven fishery in some of these sections, they will only really start feeding when there's a hatch on.
Okay, yeah. You mentioned cicadas there. That's something that we actually hadn't mentioned till that point. They're obviously quite a big feature of the South Island fishery as well. What time of year is best for the cicada fishing?
Probably from December onwards. It's when you can hear them really chirping, and they're very, very loud, in February, January. When it's warmer, they'll tend to take to the wing. They're a sort of a strange creature, the cicada. They march to the beat of their own drum. But fish remember cicadas because it's such a big meal ticket item.
Mm.
They may not have seen one for 6 months. So it's always worth throwing a cicada. If you see a beech tree, someone can point out to you what a beech tree looks like.
Google it.
Google it. When you see a beech tree, throw a cicada. That's my rule.
Yeah, right. Okay. You've obviously done so many trips to the South Island now. I'd imagine when you're planning, it's a bit of a well-oiled machine. How much trial and error to that point was there? Did you have any things that didn't work out when you planned a trip, or has it always been pretty smooth sailing since your first trip?
No such thing as smooth sailing, but I like to create what I call an operation order, so everybody knows, for my group trips, everybody knows where they got to be, when they've got to be there. We plan every day the night before,
mm-hmm.
so depending on weather or, might be a few days before, the weather, how much rain there's been, what's working well. So we tend to put a little bit of research in beforehand, like that night, where are we going to go tomorrow, what's going to work. But trial and error comes about through obviously going there, so get there. Using guides is really important for the first timers, whether you're on a trip with me or with someone else. Using a guide, not necessarily to find the fish, I advocate you don't go to a guide and say, I just want to catch a trophy, is you go to them and say, I want to learn.
Mm.
And they'll take you somewhere and teach you how to fish New Zealand, in the places where you're likely to be going.
Yeah. And, of course, for guide recommendations, we're pretty well connected in that space. So popping in or giving us a call for a guide recommendation means that you are going to get that learning experience. Because I'd say New Zealand is probably a place where there's a lot of part-time guides. Is that true? Like they're kind of anyone could be a fishing guide to a certain degree?
That's right. So the professional guides, it's the New Zealand Professional Fish and Game Angler Guides Association, and there's a couple of people there. I won't name them here, but you know who you are, Chris. we'll recommend some guides to you. There are plenty of people there who are working guides, and they're also sheep shearers. And that's not a criticism. It's just what they do to fill in some time. And everybody's got to start somewhere.
That's right.
But the professionals work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Which is fundamentally more important when you're wanting to learn. I think there's probably a ton of people in New Zealand that will take you out for a day's fishing and put you on to good fish. Yep. But that learning experience and then developing the skills to be able to DIY and have success, it's a very different thing.
Oh, absolutely. There's certain things that the fish do in New Zealand that's different from what we do here. But you can take that experience and use it here. We don't tend to blind fish too much in New Zealand unless there's absolutely nothing to be seen, and then we'll work the ripples. You know, that's not something we do too much of here that we specialise in. But the Mataura, especially lower down, you can basically park a party of anglers on a big ripple further down towards Gore and just stay there all day.
Wow.
Yeah. There's so many fish in the system further down. And you work the ripples in a particular way. Don't have to move all that far because the fish will keep moving through there from the bigger pools. But further up, and it starts where it starts to get technical, is you need to find the fish. Don't blind fish.
Mm.
Don't just go casting, you know, willy-nilly. Find the fish, work out what it's eating, change a fly. Don't want to go too much into war stories, but, I mean, one fish I swear I changed the fly 12 times and I finally got to eat it. I got it to eat. 2 days later, I caught the same fish. And clearly, I went straight back to the fish, the fly that I'd caught it on 2 days ago and put that on and caught it straight away.
Yeah.
So they can be quite specific, only eat a specific thing.
Mm.
So the rule of thumb is if you see a fish and you've made a good cast to it and it hasn't eaten it, change it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Which is not something we'd focus, you know, we tend to worry about too much here. We'll just keep throwing hoppers at it till it eats something.
Yeah, yeah. But,
not there.
Yeah, okay. Do you, when you're casting at a fish and you've made a presentation with a fly, you think it was an okay presentation but it doesn't get a reaction from the fish, are you still thinking, oh, no, he definitely saw that? How do you know when you've actually shown that fish the fly?
It'll move.
It'll move, right. So
it'll move to look at it. There'll be some change in its – slight change in its behaviour. If you've made a cast with a, you know, a 2 millimetre bead on it and the fish hasn't moved, go heavier.
Yeah.
The water's quite clear. It's deeper than you think and it's faster than you think. So you might play around with the same fly but getting different depths. You know, we're talking nymphing here. Until that you're positive that fish has seen it, and then change it or put a big streamer on.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So the streamer, is that a bit of a last resort fly for you? How does the streamer fishing fit into the overall, you know, technique?
Last resort.
Yeah.
So if the fish is lying doggo and it's ignored everything because, it's been annoyed or it's just for whatever reason, tie a big streamer on, cast it upstream and rip it, absolutely rip it past this fish to try and get an aggression strike out of it.
Right.
Yeah, it's not a softly presentation.
No. Is that just the territorial, instinct of the fish that you're preying on there?
You don't see a lot of small fish, Andrew.
Yeah, yeah.
they get eaten by the big fish pretty quickly.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do you think part of the reason there's not a lot of the smaller fish in those systems too is the floods that they seem to get almost annually?
Yeah. So floods will happen at least every year, sometimes 2 or 3 times a year. And those floods, like the Eglinton's a great example. So it's very steep valleys, part of fjordland. And that will knock all the fish. Like a decent flood there and you'll see enormous amounts of water going down there on the charts that we have. And it'll knock all the fish back down to the lake. And so it'll take 2, 3, 4 weeks for the fish to repopulate the river.
Mm.
And I'm talking big fish.
Right.
So those fish cannot hold. Even the big fish can't hold their position in the river. Wow. They'll just go down.
Yeah.
So you've got to be aware of what's happened previously. And, if you're not catching any fish, there might be a reason for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you find when you're there, you have to be quite adaptable to moving around?
Yep. So, like in our blog that we've written, talk about camper van. I mean, camper vans are great because of the mobility. There are some negatives to it. But not, if you're based in Lumsden or Athol where we're based, it's not too far to get to another valley. But you might have to drive 2 hours to get around to somewhere else or to get down to the Catlins, you know. So, being not just going to this over the fence.
Mm.
We're fortunate that we can actually go over the fence where we're based. And walk 150 metres from the kitchen and start catching fish. But sometimes we've got to drive a bit further. Got to be adaptable.
Is that pretty simple for, you know, any old one that's found their way to the South Island to know what other valley may have been avoided by the rain? Like, how do you know just driving over that mountain range is going to get you to cleaner, clearer water?
Most of the rivers there, if you look online, you'll be able to see the flow charts.
Right.
And so, and it's got the historical last 2 weeks or whatever, and you see how much flow they've had.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'll show a graph. So you'll see it going up.
Mm.
You go, oh, they've had a flood, you know, 2 days ago, leave it alone.
Yeah.
It'll be dirty. And just keep moving until you find clean water. And there's plenty of creeks that clear very quickly.
Mm.
Not the main rivers, but the smaller creeks will clear very quickly. And that's the case with a, you know, not a massive flood, but a good rain event, not necessarily bad for the fishing.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And the fish, do they move into those smaller creeks from the main rivers in order to get out of the what might be dirty or bigger water that they have to work harder to be in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you'll see the Mataura will be about a big rain event the day before, and you get up in the morning and it's uncrossable.
Mm.
It's not chocolate, but it's dirty. Just wait. You know, by lunchtime, you're right.
Yeah,
up until then, you work any inflowing creeks, start throwing, am I allowed to say squirmy wormies on this podcast?
I think it's been said before.
All right. So, yeah, squirmy wormies.
This isn't the cleanest podcast.
All right. So, squirmy wormies on the flooded edges will produce fish.
Okay.
Yeah. And then by lunchtime, it's usually cleared up and you're right to go again.
Mm. So similar to fishing at home, you know, like the side current that is that little bit more calm tends to be holding water, you know, during high flows.
Yeah, absolutely. So the fish don't really, they don't panic for just a rain event, but it's just like big scouring floods. That's what you want to avoid as much as possible.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about gear selection. As far as rods are concerned, what are you packing to take to the South Island?
5 and 6 weight rods. Euro rods have a place as well. There's nothing wrong with those. But if you only had one rod to, you know, to take, a 5 weight would probably be the one.
Yep.
Or, you know, like if it's windy, go somewhere else. But that's not always an option. So if you've got a 5 weight rod, make sure you've got a line that, you know, matches that. Probably carry. If I've got one rod, I'll carry two lines just for wind.
Mm. And so one would be of a more aggressive nature for dealing with the wind, and then something a little more delicate for, say, willow grub feeders at close range.
Absolutely. You know, I've seen guys have great success late in the afternoon casting 3 weight lines or 5 weight rods to keep the delicate presentation.
Mm.
Yeah, so matching lines to rods is really important. But generally, if you go with a 5 and a 6 weight rod, most people have got multiple rods.
Mm.
5 and 6 weight rods. I've been to New Zealand, North and South Island. I've probably been to New Zealand for, you know, 30-something trips. I always carry spare rods.
Mm.
You know how many I've broken, Andrew?
None. Yeah. Yeah. So, you're not a rod breaker. We do have some staff members that are rod breakers, but you're pretty good.
Yeah. So I've broken plenty of other things, always you wouldn't go with one rod. But if you've got the luxury of taking two rods, take a 5 and a 6 weight.
Yeah. So six for dealing with the wind and bigger flies and bigger stuff. But then I guess the 5 for the more delicate presentation would be ideal.
Yep. Absolutely.
Cool. What about, those rivers, obviously, they can be pretty boisterous. Let's talk a bit about some wading gear that people might need.
Okay, so you'll see Kiwis walking around wearing, I don't know if they still sell stubbies or whatever, but rugby shorts, in the middle of winter, up to their armpits in the river. Okay, that's not us.
Right?
We're just not built that tough. So
speak for yourself.
Yeah. So wet wading is really, really popular in New Zealand. I've wet waded in New Zealand all the time, especially in South Island. I have packed the lightweight waders. I don't tend to wear them very much, but they certainly have a place. But I used to say lightweight just because I've got a you know, got to carry so much gear. I don't want to have a very heavy pair of waders in there. But wet wading, really popular, and that would be the number one outfit. Mm. But long walks, very long walks. So, I like the flyweight access boots, shoes. So anything light that you can do 15, 20 kilometres in is in a day is ideal. Mm. And, you know, match it up with long pants. Yeah, we're not that tough. Wear long pants. We've got, I wear the Sims and I've got the Squalor pants now, the long pants, which I'm very keen to try out.
Yeah.
But, yeah, long pants, good boots. Good socks.
Yeah, so I guess the real takeaway there is the fact that you are going to be covering ultra long distances walking. And so every gram that you have on your body is going to make a difference to the fatigue levels at the end of the day. So in the wading gear, that's probably a real area where you can minimize on what you have on your body, you know, whether that be a lighter weight pair of waders, a quick dry pair of pants, a wet wading shoe as opposed to a wading boot, no neoprene socks, that kind of thing. It really, if you want to be comfortable out there, then there are items of gear that are just so ideally suited to the South Island fishery.
Yeah, and there's no snakes.
Yeah.
So you don't need to worry too much about gators, but being mobile is, you know, clambering fences, getting up and down over the rocks, and it's just, I can't stress enough, the ability to be mobile and, you know, you don't have to be super, super fit, but you need to be mobile. And whereas, you know, I've got the lightweight waders and usually I don't even notice I've got them on, but when I'm spending 30 days in a row fishing, the wet wading, I'll just hang everything out to dry, put it on again in the morning and just keep going. So those boots are wet. My boots are wet for 30 days.
Yeah.
And you, in a row, you soon work out which boots work. And we can recommend some here.
We certainly can. Yeah. It's, I mean, there's something nice and liberating about wet wading as well, I would say. Like, it's kind of feeling the water around your legs because, I mean, I wear waders almost always, but when I do wet wade, I'm like, oh, this is actually quite nice. Like, you've just done a big hike and then you get into the water and it's a nice way to cool down. So there is something quite good about it. But I think it's important to have a barrier on your legs. I think skin, naked skin of your leg on brush and sticks and stuff, that's, you know, probably fine for a day, but over multiple days, your legs will just get so chopped up. So you do need some kind of barrier there.
Yeah, people say, oh, but what? But wet wading, I'll get cold. My response to that is, well, if you get cold, get out of the water. Like, it really is that simple. If it gets a bit cold, jump out of the water, you'll dry off in wearing wading pants, and you'll dry off in a matter of minutes and you'll be warm again. Like, yeah. It really is that simple. But we haven't spoken about sand flies, but if you haven't built up a resistance to sand flies, please do not wear shorts.
Yeah.
You're going to die.
Yeah, yeah. That you're right. We need to mention that because they are absolutely brutal. And to an Aussie that's not familiar with the South Island sand fly, it's a real steep sort of, this place looks idyllic, but I hate it. Because they're that bad, aren't they? Like, they can ruin a day. And I think if you, they say that maximum sort of two or three nights camping in Fiordland is really all any sane person can do because the sand flies are that relentless.
Yeah, look, some of the worst sand fly bites I've ever had have been getting changed in between taking your wet wading gear off and putting your driving gear back on. If you're standing in the grass, they're going to eat your ankles. So we have the Sims Taco bag here, which you lay down on the ground, you stand on. That gives you massive protection from sand flies. I wouldn't travel without it.
Right. That's a great tip.
Because they live in the grass.
Yeah.
Don't sit in the grass to eat your lunch. don't take your your pants off. Your shoes and socks off in the grass, you'll just get eaten alive. So, so that's rule number one. Yeah. So stand on something.
Yeah. Are you a fan of the Bushman type DEET repellent?
Doesn't work. It does work. You just got to keep reapplying it. There's a really good New Zealand product, which we should have in the store, called Goodbye Sandflies.
It's probably flammable and can't be exported, but go on.
I probably shouldn't be bringing it back. That's really good. It's sort of fairly natural. Lavender oils are real good for the bites. And you can buy antihistamine creams.
Yep.
And that's the only thing that'll stop those itching. Well, so anyway, look, sand flies are really bad. You need to cover up anywhere, not just Fiordland, but pretty much anywhere. You've got to make sure that you're covered up. Sims Bug Stopper hoodies.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah. Just not called Bug Stopper for no reason. I don't know what they put in it, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's a – I mean, they talk it up as being a treatment of the fabric, but I think it's a combination of both the treatment and the tight weave nature of the material that stops them biting you through the material.
Yeah, so good hats, you know, buffs, match with Bug Stopper hoodies and gloves. Mm. You've actually got to really be covered up. Mm. I mean, the tips of your fingers will get eaten. Yeah. You can live with that, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be the tastiest area of your body for them to bite either. Like you'd get bitten there, don't get me wrong, but they don't seem to like it as much as, say, the ankle.
Oh, they love the ankle.
It's time for a short break to talk about the legends who bring this podcast to life. Our committed team at The Fly Fisher prepare, record, and edit in-house in South Melbourne. We put huge effort in for you listeners. We hope that means when it comes time to make a fly fishing purchase, you consider us. With your loyalty, we can keep producing these podcasts and bringing you the world's best fly fishing gear. So shop smart and support the fly shop that supports you.
Let's move on from sand flies, because that's potentially the only downside to South Island trout fishing, I would say, and move on to flies. Obviously, it's going to be season dependent. Obviously, probably best thing someone could do would be pop into the store and say, I'm going to be there in a month. You know, I want a full kit of flies. Can you put together a selection of 30, 40, whatever it may be? How many flies should one budget for on a per day basis for the South Island?
Not as many as you think.
Yep.
Because you're not going to be blind casting. Mm-hmm. You will lose the odd fly to a fish. Depending on where you are, there's not that, you know, you're not surrounded by trees that much. But it's having a variety and at the right time of year. I mean, obviously you could go to New Zealand and probably have, you know, four different types of flies, and that would do you. But there are going to be times when you're just scratching your head going, I wish I had some other option. So, yeah, definitely come and see us. There's certain things that you've got to have.
Yeah.
You absolutely must have at certain times of the year.
Mm. I know in talking to you, and certainly when you get back from your trips to New Zealand, there's always a few fly patterns that you're talking about just consistently and constantly that, you know, have obviously been perennial successful flies for you, that you fish quite confidently and you know are going to work if you get it in front of those fish. Are all these flies, would you say, commercially available, or are these things that you're tying yourself?
Obviously, I'll tie them myself, but they're certainly available in store. So a size 14, size 14 brown.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, like... And so Chris Dawes sort of got the Dawes depth control, which we have here, and that basically runs from, you know, a 2, 2.5, 3, 3.5 millimeter beads.
So the fly size is consistent, but the weight differs.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that's why I say before, like you find the fish, work out what you need, and then tie that on. So you're not walking around just throwing the same thing. It's almost every fish will have a different fly presented to it. To get down to it. And you can tell by the depth of water it's in. Excuse me. Certainly most fish in the South Island will not refuse a size 14 brown mayfly presented well.
Mm.
You know, not swinging past it, not going over its head, not dragging. but going past its mouth, it's probably going to eat it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that doesn't mean they're not going to eat other things, but when they're just in their normal feeding position, that's what they'll eat. Stew's pogo nymph we have in stock as well, tied behind something heavier, gives it another look. But I love an unweighted brown nymph to a fish sitting up on the top eating.
Yep.
You know, you might see it occasionally taking something off the top. Mm. But if you actually watch these fish, there's a few
purists that have just rolled their eyes at you there. If it's a rising fish and you're casting a nymph to it, is that something that you're quite okay with? Give us an argument towards, say, nymph fishing and why you really enjoy casting the nymph to a fish that's rising.
Yeah, so if I can see a fish up on the surface and it's not rising consistently and I can't work out, you know, visually what it's actually eating, like it's occasionally eating from the top, but it's sitting up in those first 6 inches of water, it's feeding.
Mm.
And it's feeding on nymphs that are floating down. So that's something like an unweighted or a pogo nymph that's just under the surface, it'll eat it. Mm. If it's like if it's a sipping fish and it's sipping on a, you know, spinners or something like that, well, that's what we'll put at it.
Mm.
But if it's uncertain what it's eating, but it's up cruising around high in the water table, that's the first thing I'll present to it.
Yeah.
Almost always works.
So it's about putting the fly on that you think in your mind is what the fish is feeding on mostly during that point in time.
Most of the league, they're eating a size 14 brown nymph.
Wow. Yeah. So, very much a mayfly driven fishery in the South Island rivers. Is that what you'd suggest?
Certainly on the Matara, where a lot of people will spend a lot of time in those sorts of slower flowing rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the, you know, some other rivers where that won't be what you want to be putting on.
Yeah. Another fly that we haven't mentioned yet is the blowfly. Is that one that is a fly that you pull out of the box regularly?
Had a young bloke on the couple of trips ago where he spent 2 hours on one fish just trying to get it to eat. Mm. And eventually it ate the fly and I said to him, oh, well done, you know, good fish. What did it eat? And he very shamefacedly said, well, that fly that you handed me first thing this morning, that was the last one he put on. And, of course, it was a blowfly.
Wow.
And I said, you know, don't forget to use that.
Yeah.
It took him 2 hours to remember to use it. But, you know, again, fish feeding on the surface, you're not quite sure what they're eating. Try a blowfly because there's, you know, sheep country up there. There's a lot of blowflies.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like it's not just a bit like the Royal Wolf. It's not a blowfly accurate representation of an actual blowfly. It's also just an attractor that gets eaten because you can fish them here and they're effective too. It's just a great fly pattern.
Yeah, so we have in store, we have the Wayne's blowfly.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really like that because it's got a little bit of rubber legs going on. It's a little bit of... It could be a little bit of anything, but it's got the coloration and the sizing of a blowfly with a little bit of bling on it as well.
Mm. Yeah, nice, mate. Okay, so I think the other essentials we pretty much covered. Sun protection is obviously key too, as much as the sandfly protection. It is brutal down there, the sun. So you're pretty much covered head to toe and trying to minimize the amount of sunscreen that you're using?
Yeah. People forget about sunscreen. They put it on, then they forget about it. You really don't want to be getting that on your flies.
Yeah.
You want to minimize the amount of sunscreen you're putting on because it gets on your flies, it gets on your lines. When they've got all the time in the world to just mosey over and have a sniff at your nymph, just don't want to give them any opportunity to go, oh, that stinks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's one reason why we want to avoid putting too much on.
Yeah. And look, this is probably, I guess the science isn't there to prove that a fish can smell sunscreen, but I have heard from too many guides and people I respect in the fishing world that say, oh, no, you cannot put sunscreen anywhere near your fly pattern to know that it's a real thing. It is obviously a real consideration for you.
Yeah, even if they can't smell it, it gives off a, you know.
Like a greasy chemical, kind of.
Yeah, greasy, it looks greasy or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So wash your hands really well after applying sunscreen or use a roller.
Totally agree, mate. Now, we've touched on it a little bit, but let's dive a little bit deeper into it. The South Island top regions, let's start with maybe the people that have flown into Christchurch and then headed directly west or towards and or north from Christchurch. Give us a bit of a snapshot of that area and maybe some key rivers that one should check out.
Okay, well, it's probably, without getting diving too deeply into rivers, river names, it's probably areas. So Hanmer Springs is, if you've landed in Christchurch, you've gone to get your rental car and you've gone done a bit of shopping, you know, whatever you've done to get ready for the trip, Hanmer Springs is about an hour and a half out of town. There's a whole bunch of rivers that run down to the east coast from there. That's a really good stop for a night. There's mm-hmm. a couple of very good rivers down there. Then you start heading to the west coast to Greymouth. And again, anywhere in New Zealand where you're crossing a bit of water, there's trout in there.
Yeah.
That's another, an hour and a half. Then you've head up towards Nelson. So Nelson from Christchurch is actually quite a drive. I've actually flown into Christchurch and then got an internal flight to Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
Because Nelson it's just spectacular walking fishing and helicopter fishing in that area. The Marlborough Sounds, all of that. It's too many rivers to mention. Again, come into the shop, give us a bit of a snapshot of what you'd like to do, and we can probably point you in the right direction. So that's the north and, headed north from Christchurch. Headed west to your first port of call is probably Greymouth on the west coast, and then mm-hmm. New Zealand's a very good sense of humour. They call it the wet coast for a reason. So take a raincoat. We haven't touched on raincoats, but you'll need a raincoat. all the water's running down into the ocean there, all hold trout. And again, that's somewhere where rain events, you need to be able to move.
Okay.
Move fairly quickly up or down the coast depending on where the rains hit.
Right. Yeah. So would you head inland to get away from the weather or what are you doing?
If it's really, really rainy,
yeah.
Probably head to some of the lakes that are there, like Lake Brunner.
Yep.
Brunner. Head to some of the lakes there and mm-hmm. wait out. Because as I said before, the reason the rivers clear really quickly is it's falling on rocky ground, so it tends to not hold the water, and water tends to hit the ground and rush through the system,
mm-hmm.
and that's why it clears quite quickly. So it's not falling on normal sort of farmland.
Yeah.
So the rivers can rise and fall very quickly. Also, it's a danger if you're out on it.
We're obviously talking a lot about the rivers, but you mentioned some lakes there. Is the lake fishing in the South Island any good?
Doesn't get the attention the others do, but the Canterbury, the Canterbury High Lakes are just, you can spend weeks there just lake fishing in the Canterbury High Lakes, and
wow.
Yeah, and all, a lot of the I spend more time on the lakes around down. Further south, Wanaka, various lakes, and based yourself in Wanaka. Wanaka you can reach quite easily from Queenstown or Christchurch. So I was a little bit further from Christchurch, but there's no reason you can't land in Christchurch and fish your way down south to the Wanaka region.
And so central South Island, if someone was doing that, driving basically north to south, I guess, does it have anything to offer in terms of good trout fishing, central South Island?
The lake fishing there, and again, it's Polaroiding. You don't need to go out in a boat, but you Polaroid the lakes. You're going to be putting some miles on your feet. And there's some quite specific sort of techniques, depending on which lake you're going to. The lake fishing there is sensational, and there's quite a few lakes that are linked with canals and, various waterways that hold, some very, very large fish.
Can we get into a bit of detail on what these lake techniques are that you're talking about?
Okay, so the fish there love their version of a crayfish or a coro.
Oh, yeah. I think
they call it. So yeah. They eat a lot of crayfish. But polar auring is the main thing we're trying to – they'll patrol.
Mm.
You watch a trout patrol and then you basically just waylay them.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. With a quite large streamer pattern to imitate these – yes. New Zealand yabbies?
Yep. Yeah, so we have those in store. But again, you come and see us, we'll sort out where you want to go, sort out what you need.
Do those cruising fish along the edges eat a mayfly nymph very well?
They'll eat anything that's presented well and just you're going to have to watch the fish behaviour. So fishing with a partner is just critical. Well, I suppose we've really touched on that, but Two people is nice. Three people is even better, where you've got multiple spotters working together to work out what the fish are doing. Because quite often you can't see it from where you are.
Mm.
So you need to be called into a fish. So working with others, working out what they're actually doing, what they're feeding on. Anywhere that's got overhanging willows in the lakes, you want to be walking really quietly through there and looking for willow feeders.
Mm-hmm.
Willow grub feeders. Fish are very, very particular, and you need the right. You need to a willow grub pattern. Excuse me, willow grub pattern that needs to be fished well.
Yeah, I think an interesting fact of information that I heard was that Australia, we obviously have mayfly in both our lakes and our rivers, whereas New Zealand only has mayfly in running water and no mayfly in lakes. So I guess that determines a little bit the fly selection for still waters as well.
Yeah, well, that's right. They eat a lot of bullies, they call them. Right. So they're a small fish.
Mm.
So they eat a lot of bullies, a lot of crayfish. Obviously, there'll be a few insects getting about, but cicadas. And again, we see a beech tree on the side of a lake, we change.
Mm.
And we look for that because those fish will just cruise around certain areas where they know their food, where the food is,
yeah,
and just work on what you think they're going to be eating.
Yeah, very cool. So I guess we've touched a little bit on the central stuff, then getting down further south, which we've already spoken in a fair bit of depth about, the Mataura, the Eglinton. How much water down there is easily accessible?
Bit of an issue at the moment, just with a little bit of a to and fro with the Farmers Federation and DOC with river access, but that should be sorted out, hopefully, before too long. A complicated political backstory, but let's not worry about that. There is so much water there. Even when Kiwis were complaining loudly on social media that I went fishing and I couldn't get a spot because of all the foreigners and, I fished in February after COVID when it's as busy as I've ever seen it.
Mm.
I found fish every day. I found a spot every day, you could always find a spot. If there's people there, go to the next spot.
Mm.
So much water is accessible. And so that's why it's so popular.
Yeah.
There's so much water. There's so many, there's still quite a lot of fish. It's not thousands of fish. Mm. If you look online, they count the fish. So they do drift drives and they tell you how many fish per kilometre there are in each section of the river if you look for it.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. No, that's good, mate. I think that gives us a bit of a snapshot of the various areas of New Zealand. What do you think would be one of the major pitfalls of someone that's turned up to the South Island with not enough preparation? What kind of mistakes are they likely to make that could be avoided?
If you've turned up and you don't have a great casting game, and I don't mean by that, you don't need to cast the entire fly line, but a good, strong, accurate cast, you're going to struggle and fast. I talk to people all the time about line management. People have been on trips with me, they're probably having nightmares, but line management so approach every section of water with the fly in your hand, line out of the rod tip, ready to go.
Mm.
They don't, be standing there with a trophy fish in front of you
mm.
and the fly line connected to your mm. jumper and round your foot and
be ready.
Be ready. Don't have the line.
The blackers will be on to you.
And this is for you, Dean. Don't hook your first fish in New Zealand with your line wrapped around your thigh.
Yeah. Look, I think it's for the Aussie fly fisher that's not used to catching large trout, there is a lot of skill gained from learning that skill. You know, like it's a difficult one that is hard to practice at home. Casting, yeah, sure. I mean, we can all do so much more casting preparation and should, but when it comes to tackling large fish, it's something that can only be acquired with experience.
Yeah, so some of the rivers, you get sick of 3-pound fish.
Mm.
Like you just, oh, God, not another one, because you're always chasing something bigger.
And this is not, how spoilt you are in the South Island of New Zealand.
And by that I mean after 4 or 5 3-pound fish,
mm.
you know how hard that drag can be set to. You know how hard you can work those fish before, you know that you can actually put a fair bit of pressure on those fish with your rod, your reel, your tippet that you have. I don't advocate going 7X on these rivers. But, so it's a great learning experience for how to handle big fish. I have a particular, I'd like to get people to bring it downstream quickly mm-hmm. and then turn the fish, so keep it out of the way of other fish that we might be fishing next.
Yep.
Get it downstream very quickly and then turn its head and turn its head and turn its head,
mm-hmm.
Get it disorientated so we can get it in quickly.
Yeah.
We can work these fish harder than you think.
Mm. We kind of bang on about it a fair bit, but the winding hand actually has a fair bit of a job to do when a big brown trout or rainbow trout swims towards you. So you need to be able to wind fast, don't you, just to keep contact with the fish?
Yeah. So a lot of people, they naturally gravitate towards winding with their left hand. Putting line on in the shop, you know yourself that winding with your left hand when we're, spooling a reel up, how slow it is with your left hand, your non-dominant hand
mm-hmm.
versus your dominant hand. So you can, for right-handed people, you can wind so much faster with your right hand. So probably step away or give some consideration to, swapping over to wind with your right hand. Some of these big rivers, especially when they've got a bit of a flow in them, you've got a 5 or 6-pound fish that's running down, you're going to be running with it and trying to recover line as fast as you can.
Yeah, I think, the fish are bigger and it's probably more akin to saltwater fly fishing than it is your typical trout fishing. I think in most trout fishers, it's a bit of a non-event. You're probably going to strip 90% of your trout in anyway and the reel handle's never going to get moved. But, certainly they can pull a lot of string down there and you need to be able to keep in touch.
Yeah, and being able to get a fish under control quickly.
Mm.
Like there's bits of the Matara behind our lodge there where in a 100-metre run, there's probably 23 to 4 5-pound fish all out feeding of an evening.
Mm.
You do not want the fish running upstream and taking the rest of them with them.
Yeah.
So you need to get it on the drag and get it to the net quickly.
Yeah. No, it's a bloody good point, mate. We've talked a little bit about transport options being the camper van and a vehicle, obviously. Camper van obviously opens up a bit of access. What are the downfalls to the camper van idea?
Space. Yeah, so there's a limited amount of space and you've got waders or, wet wading gear and boots and all the rest of it and, multiple fly rigs rigged up and it tended to get a bit messy. I've done the 10-day camper van trip and it was good and it gave us some riverside access to some places, but it doesn't really give you any real advantages.
Okay.
No matter where you are in New Zealand, you're probably not that far from the river.
Yeah. Yeah. So these days it's more booking a bit of accommodation for you?
Oh, absolutely. Like I've got my my lodge, I like to call it.
Yep.
And literally, you know, it's 200 metres over the fence onto the river.
Mm.
So people that come on trips with me, they land at Queenstown at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 9 o'clock that night, everybody's hooked a fish or landed a fish.
Wow.
You know, that's good. You know, and I think on the last trip, Roger had 3 fish by 9 o'clock, you know.
Incredible, eh? Yeah, that good. Yeah, I think there's nothing better than just jumping off a plane and then scratching the itch straight away. You know it's going to be a good week of fishing when that happens.
Yeah, so, yeah, New Zealand's got some great low-budget options. It's got some real high-end options as well. But if you just want to just travel around, there's so many options. And, you know, if you're booking 1 or 2 days and then moving on, you know, if you change your plan for the weather, you have a hot shower every day, you know, it's pretty good, good.
Yeah. Do you need a four-wheel drive? Is that a handy thing to have or?
Sometimes. I don't tend to worry about it. Almost everywhere we go, we can access via walking and, you know, parking pretty close. New Zealand has done an enormous amount of work on providing access to anglers.
Yeah. No, that's a great thing really for us as travelling anglers. Affordable accommodation options, you know, like the what's the cost of doing like a hosted thing in the way that you do a hosted trip to the South Island?
Okay, so mine's a little bit niche, I guess. So for my, you know,
it's not a guide, just a you know, I guess create the picture. It's not a guided experience as such. It's not a 5-star lodging accommodation sort of thing. This is a budget way to get an inside run to good fishing, great fishing, in fact.
Yeah, so I would say if you wanted to go for 7 days and fly in, get yourself, you know, not my trip, but get yourself a guide for 1 day, get some accommodation, get some food, get some drinks, all of those sorts of things, get a license. It's a $3,000 week.
Yeah.
And that's hiring a guide for 1 or 2 days.
Wow.
Shared, obviously, between yourself and a mate, because that's the good ones are over $1,000 a day.
Yep.
It's only New Zealand money, so not quite so bad, but still not cheap.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds pretty bloody affordable, really. When you're booking accommodation, though, are you confining yourself to one area? Have you ever kept it pretty loose in terms of what you've booked and locked in, or is it always planned as to, no, on that night we're going to be staying at location X?
Okay, for my my hosted trips, obviously we've got the lodge, we go to the lodge and we work out of the lodge.
Yeah.
If I'm going by myself, I might book the first night out of Queenstown and then I just freewheel from there.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, and again, depending on weather, like if it's great where we are, we'll just extend our stay. There's a lot of accommodation, you know, in Lumsden, Athol, Garston. These are all on the road south of Queenstown.
Yeah.
Tianu.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tons and tons of accommodation there.
Yeah. Is there at some times of year, is it quite busy and you struggle to find accommodation, or is it generally speaking New Zealand is just so well set up for the tourists and you can pretty much find something always?
Yeah. Look, February gets a little bit busier, but you know, you're not probably booking, you know, the week before you go.
Mm.
But yeah.
No, that's good.
Get your first 2 nights sorted so you get your feet, you know, wet, so to speak, and then work it out from there.
Terrific, mate. For you, you know, South Island fishing, have you got any memories of just great fish that you've caught or things that you've seen on the water? Can you give us an example of say, like a big fish story or something that will stick with you forever?
It's probably the ones that get away.
Yeah.
You know, like we're guiding on a river that remain nameless, and as will the participants. But, you know, two of us are on a high bank, you know, sheltered from by the trees, looking down on a 10-pound plus fish with an angler, you know, in a good position, which is why I bang on about line management, because unfortunately the angler couldn't get his fly to the fish while it was sipping something from the top. Just, you know, only metres away from it, you know, 3 or 4 metres away. just watching it all unfold and then the fish just drifting back down and then going on a bit of a circle and, you know, screaming freeze, 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 and the fish still spotted him and just drifted back into the, you know, like the, it's the opportunities. I mean, we catch plenty of, you know.
Good ones,
you know, 8 pound sort of thing. You know, probably my best fish in New Zealand. I caught with Chris Dorr, you know, calling me onto the fish and probably making the best cast of my life, you know, at distance.
Yeah.
You only get one shot at these fish, these big ones. You know, it's a magnificent fish, you know, like great memories and great filming too by Chris.
I was all captured.
Oh, all captured, mate,
awesome, yeah.
I was a much younger man back then.
No, I think the one of the things I've noticed in trips to the South Island that you're going to see arguably the biggest trout of your life in a week's fishing in the South Island. Like, you will get an opportunity at something it's so big that you've never, probably never even thought that trout exist of that size. It sticks with you.
Yeah, well, I was on the first time I fished the Eglinton, moving reasonably quickly so that I, cover the water and, just a bit of an exploration. And I bumped into a guide who jumped me on the river, but that's another story. But he said, mate, you're moving too fast. I'm going, well, he said, that big pool you're back there, they're not boulders, mate. Go back and have another look. And I thought, I don't want to start World War III here. I'll wander back to the cars.
Yep.
You know, it's lunchtime anyway. I wandered back and I stopped in this big pool. I don't know how deep it was, but it could have parked several cars in there. I'm looking at the boulders going, I don't know what she's talking about. And then the boulders started moving. and they were, I don't know how big they were, but they were, 15 pound plus fish.
Yeah.
Just moving very slowly up a, and they do look like boulders.
Mm.
Probably that's something we haven't touched on, how to spot fish. So when you turn up, you asked me before about, people just turning up blind. It'll take you a long time to learn to spot the fish quickly. So you'll be spooking a lot of fish. And that's something a guide can help with, or, someone who's been there before can help you with. On my trips, I think most people, the knowledge that takes them 3, 4, 5 days before they'll spot the fish as quickly.
Yeah.
You know, because there's the particular colour that they are, there's a particular places where they sit where you can short circuit the search by looking at certain places in the river. And that's what experience gives you.
Right.
Yeah. So guides or experienced people really make a big difference.
Yeah. When you wrote the South Island DIY guide for the fly fishers blog, you do mention there, what is it on the gravel gravel spit or something you describe it as?
Tell us about that. Don't want to give away secrets, Andrew.
Well, you've published it, so.
I'll probably do. So with the types of gravel they generally find there is that where the water flows slows, there's a buildup of finer gravel and it's a different colour. So if you can imagine a shelving rock, a shelving beach, and it has sand and then it's got a different sort of sand and then it starts to have pebbles and then it's got bigger rocks.
Yeah.
So the fish are sitting in that softer water and you can actually see like there's a particular, it's a white stripe down the river and you just look either side of that white stripe and that's where you'll find the fish are waiting because they're essentially very lazy.
Yeah. So that's just the softest current in the river.
So that's where it deposits that fine sand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it obviously must be a bit of a corridor for food as well.
Yeah, it's just very easy for them. The things fall to there. The fine sand falls to there and so do the nymphs.
Yeah, wow. Okay. No, that's a bloody great tip. Obviously, a decent set of Polaroids is a pretty essential piece of equipment to be taking as well.
Yeah, look, I would advocate the low light glasses.
Yep.
I really love them for New Zealand just because I get a bit of cloud cover and looking under the willows and this sort of thing. So generally a little bit better, all round. But I do carry the two pairs, the brown and then the low light lenses.
Yeah, okay. Yep. And the brown you're pulling out on those more bright sunny days.
Yeah, the big bright days on the Eglinton or the wide open rivers. Something, again, that comes with experience is when you're trying to Polaroid into, you need backdrop.
Yep.
So the Ariete is particularly bad for not having a backdrop.
Right.
So if by that I mean you've got to have something behind the you know, in line with the water. Like if there's yep. a tree, you can see underneath it.
Yep.
The water underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And you look past the tree, you can't see anything because there's no because of the glare.
Mm.
So your best Polaroids are required there. You know,
looking into that.
And again, using the backdrop to your advantage, crossing the river, getting the sun in the right position, backdrop in the right position. Otherwise, you can't see anything.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not just about the Polaroids you're wearing. It's also about getting in a position where the glare is less so you can just cut through that surface.
Absolutely, So being smarter.
Mm. Yeah, now that's a great tip. And in a lot of cases, you're splitting up from, say, the angler in order to get that glare-free vision while the angler stays put in a realistic place where he can make a presentation.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the big things we advocate, do not walk along the riverbanks.
Yep.
Yep. So by that I mean constant little circular movements.
Mm-hmm.
So you're moving away from the river then coming straight back into it. So you're not walking straight along the bank.
Mm.
So you're arriving at the river and looking into the river and trying to stay stationary and stay low, obviously.
Yeah.
These fish are, these fish can see you as well as you can see them.
Tell me, like, as a preference, are you doing a trip to the South Island with a mate because it is such a team fishery, as in you're more productive doing it as a duo than you are as a single, or are you preferring to do it on your own?
Always prefer to doing with someone. A couple of reasons. One is safety. Depending on where you are, it can be quite remote, big rivers. You don't want to be falling in the water on your own,
Yeah, I guess this is a topic that's pretty relevant at this point in time, given that you've broken your hand, finger. What have you done, mate? Tell us about your little fishing injury that you've
Well, we've just come back from the North Island, the annual trip to the Tongariro. First hour, had the waders, had the boots on, hadn't quite settled into anything, and I put both feet on a boulder that decided to roll down the river. So my feet went from underneath me and I fell down and landed on my hand. Shook it off like the true man that I am. And
tough.
4 weeks later, I have an x-ray and discover a broken finger.
Yeah, wow.
But it could have been a lot worse. But having someone with you is for a safety thing is really important, but having a second set of eyes and just take it turn upon turns, someone finding the fish and then calling you onto it. People that have been with me will probably get sick of me saying go again.
Mm.
That's by that I mean keep going, it hasn't seen it, go right, go left, because I can see the fish, or whoever can see the fish knows where the fly is and knows the fish hasn't seen it.
Mm.
You need to cast more right, left, go heavier, go lighter, watching the fish. Mm. We do a lot of naked nymphing as well.
Yeah. So that's like indicatorless nymphing, is it?
Yeah, that's right. So okay. It's not euro nymphing. It's just a nymph at the end of a normal leader or an extended normal leader. And watching the fish's reaction.
Mm.
So you might not be able to see it, but I can see the fish had just opened his mouth and I'll call strike.
Yeah.
Or lift.
Cool. And leaders, what sort of length of tapered leader are we fishing in the South Island typically on the rivers?
As long as you can.
As long as you can realistically cast, would you say?
Yeah. So 20 feet. Probably very extreme, very, very difficult to cast, but that would be the absolute extreme.
Mm.
But 15 feet would be the norm, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, 15 to 18 feet.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. So starting with like, say, a scientific angler, 14-foot leader in like a 3X or something like quite heavy and then tapering down from that?
Yep, absolutely, yeah. Right. Yeah. And again, you've got to match that up with, your fly lines. You've got to match it up with the wind that you're experiencing on the day and be prepared to swap them out, swap out a leader, depending on what you're casting.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. No, that's a great tip, mate. One of the products that I've found really useful for my DIY trips to New Zealand has been that John Kent guidebook on both the South Island and the North Island. You've obviously been so many times, you're probably not flicking through the pages of that or need to anymore, but how good a tool is that for someone that's wanting to get at least an idea of what the river might have to offer?
Yeah, so Kent can be summarised in his what he writes about each river. It basically says best fished early or late in the season. Mm. I mean, that's my little joke, but look, along with you don't always have the internet in New Zealand. It's a small country, so there's not a lot of people in it. I don't always have the internet, so arriving somewhere and being able to pick up a book, you know, like crossing a river and picking up a book and going, oh, hang on, I'm just going to flick through this because I don't have the internet.
Yep.
Yeah. It's all well and good to have the internet, but if you don't have it. So being able to pick up that book as you cross a river and just stop and go, oh, okay, well, if I go up here, I can, you know, do this, that and the other and the access is here. That's just, you know, can't beat it.
Yeah, no, for sure, mate. Yeah, look, I think that's given a lot of information for people that might be wanting to plan a trip there. Obviously, it is one of the most affordable fly fishing trips that you can do and in arguably the world's best trout fishery. There's really no excuse for someone not to get over there and do this stuff, is there?
Yeah, I mean, we can go fishing in Australia and obviously we know there's great fishing in Australia. Obviously, cormorants have had a major impact on some of the rivers, which will improve over the coming weeks, obviously. But going to New Zealand and just the quality of the fishing is, you know, it's why people fly from all over the world. Just final aside on the timings of it, I push my trips out to a little bit later in the season. February is inundated with Americans, not anything wrong with Americans, but Americans and Europeans, because that's their break.
Right.
So they're going so far for a trip, they're going to go in what they consider to be the optimum time. And, you know, you can argue that February is the optimum time for fly fishing in the South Island, but it's also the crowds.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. Well, we'll keep telling them that it's the best time to go so that we can go at a different time.
That's right.
We'll give them 1 month and we'll take the other, you know, nine.
Yeah, so you can, I mean, as I said before, you can get snowed on any, you know, any week of the year.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, Black, as you're with us, at least rostered on these days, Thursday and Friday every week, if people are interested in joining you on one of your hosted trips, is maybe popping in and chatting to you about that a realistic thing that someone can do?
Yeah, well, I have been meaning to expand it, you know, like I've just been running it for club members at this stage and, you know, it's been going pretty well. Lots of repeat customers and people enjoy it. So we'll be expanding it. So watch this space and look out for Al Rio Fly Fishing.
So Al Rio Fly Fishing on Instagram.
Al Rio Fly Fishing.
Yeah, excellent, mate. Yeah, if you do want to talk New Zealand fly fishing, please do come into the Fly Fisher and have a chat to Blackers. He's obviously very generous with his knowledge and a real asset to us here at the Fly Fisher. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast and really appreciate you listening. Cheers.
Thanks, everyone.